Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us. Hawaii Talks on The Conversation. It is Monday, June 22nd. The Obama Presidential Center is officially open to the public. We check in with an artist whose work is featured in the space, how he layers Indonesia, Kenya, Chicago, and Hawaii together to tell us about the former president. We hear about plans to build an AI data center at the University of Hawaii. It's the first of its kind in the state. We also take a look at the process for building permits, how a statewide task force wants to speed things up. And we mark International Pineapple Day and celebrate the sweet and tasty fruit. We hear how a Maui brand that's been in business for a century is adapting to the changing times.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Furniture Plus Design.
You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The Obama Presidential Center opened this weekend in Chicago. Among the art commissioned for the facility included pieces from more than two dozen artists from across the globe. This morning, we connected with artist Hugo MacLeod in Spain. He hails from Palo Alto, but has traveled the globe studying art in places that most people maybe wouldn't look. A series of his recent work entitled Burden elevates hard physical work. The piece he created for the Presidential Center pulls from a sense of place. It's entitled Hidden Reflections. His art considers Hawaii, Chicago, Kenya, and Indonesia, places that meant something to Barack Obama's life. It hangs in the dining area of the center. Here's how MacLeod explains his work.
Simply put, I feel like individuals that rise to such a high level of notoriety or power or place in life, there's usually like a very quick once over of where they came from and all the little things. And I think that for me personally, in my experience of growing and what I do, sometimes it's the little things that are completely overlooked or not even talked about that are the most meaningful moments to that journey. And so when I looked at Barack Obama's kind of life and trajectory and place of origin and all the different places of origin, it made me think about how he must travel back in his mind to all these different specific moments, private moments that he may have had in these different places, and how much he could probably see that those little moments shaped him and made him into what he was, that nobody else will know. That's kind of like one of the things I mentioned outside of the apartment building that he lived in Hawaii. Like, what was the corner store that he walked to, or what was the little market that he walked to, the lady that he spoke to every day, the snack that he would buy? And I think like those moments are the moments that we romanticize in life. We romanticize like when we smell those things or we see those things, it brings back a flood of memories, and maybe memories of the very important moments, but that's the kind of catalyst that like brought our attention back to that time. So with the piece, obviously I can't, without conversation, understand what those moments are. But that was what I was trying to portray to him. It wasn't really a piece for the audience or the viewer, outside of a piece that kind of gave you a general understanding of what it was. But it was more so trying to simply, even if it was only one thing, when he looks at it, he's able to transport back to those moments in time. So that was kind of like the beginning general idea around the piece. That's where I started from.
Well, you mentioned just those little moments. And when I was rereading his book, and he made mention of Tang and powdered milk and, you know, those Japanese candies with rice paper that just magically disappear in your mouth, you know, as a kid, those are just some of the memories that I connected with, right? Knowing that got a mention in his book was pretty cool.
Yeah. And I think those are the things that really, sometimes as things progress in life, sometimes I just think that those things are the most memorable moments personally to us.
And then for our listeners who may not be familiar with your work, you try and use some unusual products, right? You experiment with plastic bags and industrial materials that are often discards.
Well, yeah, that's how it started. I was in India working on block printing. And in that time of my life, up until recently, most of my travels, I traveled to a lot of what you want to call, not in a negative way, but what you want to call slums around the world. But a lot of places where manual labor was on the forefront of the visual. Because for me, I was also very much of a laborer. You know, like my work has always been very laborsome. I come from that style of family. My grandfather had a recycling yard growing up. My mom's landscape architect. So like labor and physical exertion was always part of my life. And I was in India studying block printing for a practice that I do with another material. And I came across these plastic, woven plastic sats that were used primarily from the general company that made them, whether it was agricultural or it was construction. And then it would get downcycled into being used by the people that were recycling or picking up trash or using them for their home garbage bags. And I saw how durable this material was because it was plastic. And I just thought it was a very interesting material. So from there, I brought a bunch of those back to the States and started to play around with the material and figured out a process using a clothes iron to basically fuse the materials together. And then that material progressed into the use of plastic bags. And the use of plastic bags came because I was like, wow, this is such a material that is so discarded everywhere, and it's everywhere. But I also saw something that was really interesting. You know, the first part of it was to create a process. So that was the beginning part of the work, was to create a process that would work. After I created a process, then I was trying to figure out what was I trying to communicate through this material. And what was really interesting about plastic bags is they're so fragile and so durable at the same time. And what was interesting about it is that I was in Brooklyn at the time, and I would see how the grocery stores would all use specific colors. So then if you saw that color in a different neighborhood, you knew that it came from a specific grocery store. And that's kind of as well how plastic bags are stamped with a logo or an address or something like that. So in my head, it was like, wow, imagine a 7-Eleven in Hawaii or a specific store in Hawaii. And that bag can very easily get picked up, used, taken on a plane by a customer and discarded in
another country. India. Yeah.
And now it's being used in another country by somebody, right? Or discarded or just left on the street. But then imagine somebody from Hawaii being in that other country and just simply seeing that bag walking by. That is immediately going to flood their mind with all types of memories. So I thought how interesting it was to be able to use a material. So the story that are in my paintings could be something that is non-related to the viewer, but the material and the logos and the addresses and the branding pulls everybody together.
Yes.
Now everybody is emotionally tied into this visual. And that is what I wanted to use the material as and why I found it so interesting, because I can address a subject, and that's how the Bird and Man series came about, whereas like I can address these people of labor and find the beauty and the strength in these things, of things that are completely, continually overlooked by the viewer of a different status or somebody that is not interested. But now when they see these things that actually they have familiarity to, now they're wrapped in. And now they're pulled into the story of, oh, this actually is interesting, or this is strong, or this is something to look at with a different viewpoint.
Well, I love that because, like I said, here in Hawaii, it's all about a sense of place, and that really connects us. But is there anything else that you want to share with our listeners about the piece that you created, drawing from the places that were important to Barack Obama?
Yeah, so I looked at all the kind of spaces, places that are known or written about that he comes from: Indonesia, Kenya, Hawaii, Chicago, obviously DC. And I took a bunch of mappings from those all those different areas. And those became the underlayer grid that's in the painting. And there is very subtle, but there is the lines of each one of those maps. So there's the map of Kenya. There's a map of then the area of Kenya where he was originally from. There's the map of Hawaii. There's a map of Chicago. All these are kind of wrapped into the story of the piece. So they're all those maps are kind of the underlayer starting point of it. Then I kind of wanted to not suppress, but kind of like push that back into the background so that it became very subtle. And I made it more about this idea of a simple horizon line in Hawaii. So that the horizon line that's there, it's like it was like a lake, and then there's these palm trees, but the palm trees were casting a reflection onto the water. And so that's where it was like this idea of being able to reflect back on time, reflect back on your life, reflect back on these moments that brought you to this place that you're in. Like he's now, like this is now his presidential center. It's like him being able to stand in there, he can probably go back through all the years of time like that, you know, and now he's here. So it was more so about kind of something for all of us to do is to be able to reflect back on our time here on this earth. And so that became the general storyline. And then within that, I also put the house that he lived in that recently sold, the small house, and then the apartment building that he also lived in. So it's kind of like, in a sense, a collage of imagery that I layered on top of each other. Yeah.
Well, Hugo McLeod, thank you so much for spending time with us this morning and sharing your art.
You're welcome.
That was artist Hugo McLeod. His piece at the Obama Presidential Center is titled Hidden Reflection. It hangs in the center's private dining room.
Live from the Atherton presents Inside the Song, an intimate evening of live music and conversation featuring Nā Hoku Hanahana Award-nominated songwriters sharing the stories behind their songs. Presented in partnership with the Hawaii Academy of Recording Arts. Tickets are limited and available at hbrtickets.org. This event is sponsored by HMSA.
Support for HPR comes from Lana Kila Pacific Meals on Wheels, marking 55 years of delivering meals and wellness checks to kupuna across Oahu, helping them live independently at home. LanaKilaPacific.org/MealsOnWheels.
Researchers at the University of Hawaii have been awarded more than $12 million in federal funding for AI medical research. Plans include establishing a data center. Joining us to talk about this plan is Honolulu Star Advertiser's Dan Nicasso. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning.
Yeah, so your story, I'm sure, raised some eyebrows.
It certainly did with me. My first question was about all the protests about giant data centers on the mainland that are taking up enormous amounts of energy and water and land, and whether we would have something like that here. And the answer was no. I went and saw it. It's a room in the cancer center, UH Cancer Center, about the size of a traditional garage. And it's going to cost $300,000 to convert it and outfit it with high-speed computers and whatnot. And Senator Schott says the project has no room for building something of that enormous size on the mainland. But the principal investigator from the Cancer Center says Hawaii may need to have that discussion in the future for future AI needs.
Interesting. So this is just kind of a little test.
Right. Right, but it's not going to take up all the power and water that they're consuming that's drawing all the protests on the mainland for now, and certainly not over the five-year life of this National Institute of Health funding.
Yeah, and the interesting thing, though, that your story talks about is, you know, the research, right, that's underway right now at UH, at the Cancer Center, because we have diversity. We have so much data about people's health.
That's right. So it's actually a joint project by the University of Hawaii Cancer Center, which is right next door to the University of Hawaii Medical School. So each school has its own, the Cancer Center and the school have their own principal investigators involved. So it's a co-project. But yeah, so they already have data that they're going to build out of the unique ethnicities found in Hawaii and the Pacific region. Unique not meaning Asian, but how we break down Asian, for instance, among Koreans, Filipinos, Japanese, Chinese, and the distinctions among those groups. The mainland health data centers don't account for those individual differences, which we see throughout our state, but also the region, to better detect, diagnose, and give predictions about things like skin cancer. That's very prevalent out here. So
yeah.
Maybe there are differences between Koreans and Filipinos, for instance.
Yeah, because we have that access to that longitudinal data, right? And I think it's just the most comprehensive when you
Correct.
Look at all these ethnicities.
Yeah, and the federal government could see that, hey, if we fund this project in Hawaii, it will benefit the greater good in terms of more specific markers to deal with health concerns.
Yeah, I mean, I recall, you know, a recent story of a settlement where I believe Hawaii got a piece of the money, the settlement, because I think some drug wasn't as efficient, I think, with some of the Asian population, the patients that were using it. So, yeah, it's fascinating just to see,
yes.
you know, how we can improve healthcare
right.
for everybody.
And, of course, this is early days of AI, so everybody's interested in tracking how it's used, the benefits, that kind of thing. So it's a very important project to us in terms of us, meaning Hawaii, taking a step into that AI issues and debates, and we'll see what the future brings.
Yes, we'll see where it takes us. But thank you so much, Dan.
You're welcome.
That was Honolulu Star Advertiser's Dan Nicasso. Look for the story online at staradvertiser.com.
Support for HPR comes from the State Office of Elections, reminding eligible residents to register, confirm, or update mailing addresses for the August 8th primary election. More at elections.hawaii.gov.
More than half of the seats on the Office of Hawaiian Affairs Board of Trustees are up for grabs this year. There are 19 candidates running for the 5 open seats, and it's a mix of familiar names and some newcomers. HPR's Cassie Ordonio joins us to talk about the races. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine. Thanks for having me.
Yes, it was interesting for me to see the list and see some folks that, you know, want to get back in.
Exactly. And, you know, the most crowded race that we see so far out of the 3 races is the at-large race, which is currently held by 3 incumbents, which is Brookwood Galuteria, who's a seasoned politician and former state senator. We have Keone Souza, who's also well-known. He's a real estate agent and a pretty well-known musician here in Hawaii. And then we got John Wahee IV, not the former governor. He's a son of the former governor, John Wahee III. So when I spoke with Jacob Aki of the Oahu Council of Association of Hawaiian Civic Clubs, he pointed out that this race is basically a battle of the name recognitions. That's only for the at-large race. Some of the names I will point out are politically seasoned and no stranger to campaigning. Some names that I recognize was former council member Ikaika Anderson and Kumuhula Carl Vito Baker and former trustee Brendan Kalei'aina Lee. And what Aki pointed out was, you know, there's a newcomer as well.
One of the newcomers to, I think, the political realm is Kalena Parrish, commonly known as Kalena Kuu Dilima. She is the daughter of Kapena and kind of gained recognition through her involvement with her family, you know, in that area, but also with her husband, Kala'e Parrish. You know, they've been a music duo over the past several years who also have a lot of name recognition. You know, their songs are all over the radio. She comes from a, you know, a very well-known music family. So it'll just be interesting to also see how she kind of gauges or how she navigates this race being a newcomer. But, you know, when you look at it, she's one of the only females in this race. I think that she's one of two women are running in the OHA at-large race, right? So I think from a diversity standpoint, if she's able to run not just as, you know, bring balance to the board as a woman, but, you know, to bring her experience. She's a former president of the Hawaii Academy of Recording Arts, or HARA. She's also, leads the Kapena School of Music, which is based out on the Windward side. So she also brings, I think, a lot of community experience. So like I said, it'll be interesting to see how she uses her name, you know, and her network, also a very strong social media following too.
Yeah, so the August primary elections will narrow down to the top six vote getters, and the top six vote getters will go to the November general election. What Jacob Aki was telling me is that you really got to spend money to really play the field. So they got to raise money in their campaigns to spend on like TV ads, radio, and those are very expensive. And so when I asked Jacob Aki, you know, what is the average, how much is the average cost do politicians need to raise in campaigning? He said the average is $50,000. But then you look at like other candidates in the past, like they'll raise six figures. That's in donations and whatnot, and just really getting their name out there, because you may be well known, let's say on Maui, for example, but most of the voters for the OHA races come from the most populous island of Oahu. So that's what they have to kind of consider. But another interesting couple of races is the Oahu and Maui race. Those two will already advance to the November general elections because the incumbents each have a challenger. And so for the Oahu seat, that's currently held by Kalea Kaka, who was elected as trustee in 2018-2019. She's the granddaughter of the late Hawaii Senator Daniel Akaka, and she's being challenged by Kumuhina Wong, a very well-known Native Hawaiian activist.
What Kumuhina does bring is she does bring state and national recognition. You know, people know her as the cultural icon. People know her as a LGBTQ activist. She is also known for her, you know, number of different documentaries and books. So Kumuhina does bring a unique dynamic to the race. I think she'll be able to raise money. She does just have a strong, natural community base, a large following on social media. So I think it'll be interesting to see how she uses that to really drive out voters, you know, and particularly because this race goes into the general election, it does give her time to ramp up the overall campaign. So interesting to see kind of where things go. But I think, you know, this will probably be one of the more exciting OHA races this year between trustee Kale Akaka and Kumuhina.
And the reason why he said that, because the one of the most notable challengers that Kalea Kaka had was around, I think, maybe 2018, 2019 against Esther Kia Aina. That was also a very interesting race back then. The Maui seat is currently held by incumbent Carmen Hulu Lindsay, who is the former OHA chair. And she's been on the board since 2012. So that's a very long time. And she's being challenged by a cultural practitioner, Jonah Kapu,
well-known community leader in West Maui, well-respected cultural practitioner. I think this is his second time challenging Trustee Lindsay. Trustee Lindsay has been in OHA, almost 20 years now. Obviously, her name recognition, you know, as a musician. She is the mother of Kumuhula Napua Silva. So, like, you know, there's just a lot of name recognition there statewide. But I think, you know, Kemoko Kapu, you know, his support, you know, particularly from the grassroots side within the Hawaiian community, makes it for an interesting race. This does go straight to the general, but, you know, it'll be interesting to see how Kemoko is able to overcome the name recognition. And, you know, Trustee Lindsay is a former OHA board chair, you know, longstanding, you know, in a lot of the political and community circles. So it'll definitely be an interesting race for the Maui seat.
Exciting times for OHA, actually, especially what Jacob Aki is saying is the battle of the name recognitions. And just to keep in mind, the elections is coming as OHA considers options in several areas. And that includes, you know, a potential bid to buy KITV that you were reporting mm-hmm. on, how best to develop Kaka'aku Makai and how to gain a larger role in military lease negotiations. I also want to point out that right now they don't have a actual CEO. It's an interim CEO right now. And there's ongoing litigations right now between OHA and Stacey Ferreira as well.
Yeah, it's interesting, and a lot of these names, like I said, are familiar to voters, you know, former lawmakers, and they do have the experience in that arena. But then maybe some people think, oh, it's time for fresh eyes, fresh blood.
Exactly, and like what Jacob Aki is saying, that they do these challengers really do need to raise a lot of funds to get their names out there.
Yeah, but at least people will have a choice, right?
Exactly.
And everybody needs to do their homework and bone up, because everybody gets to vote in this race.
Exactly, and that's actually what Keone Souza did, and that's how he run he won his last election. He really did his homework and raised a lot of funds the last time around.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Cassie.
Thanks for having me.
That was HPR's Cassie Ordonio. You can find her coverage at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Hawaii Department of Transportation, celebrating all graduates this season with wishes for futures that include choosing not to drink and drive.
A transition to a new permitting system appears to have slashed wait times for new buildings on Oahu. It's been 10 months since the city and county switched over to a platform called H&L Build, designed to streamline the permitting process by going digital and adding AI tools. A statewide task force is also making progress in tackling our permitting woes. The name is a bit cheeky, SPEED, which stands for Simplifying Permitting for Enhanced Economic Development. The group shared its observations with lawmakers late last month and is working on a final report and a summit to take place in January. Gregor Illigan leads the task force. He spoke with HPR's Kevin Allen about paving the way for the future of permitting in Hawaii.
When you hear permitting, it's typically the mayor leading a charge on permitting in their county. There has never been a statewide effort where we're breaking down silos from county departments and state departments and really bringing everybody together and having them talk and discuss the problems in our permitting system. The unique thing about what we're doing is we're finally breaking down these walls so these departments are talking to each other. This is probably one of the few times that the permitting directors from each county are actually talking to each other. And this is what really brings out the solutions, because some of the counties are doing something great that they can bring back to the other counties, or had a challenge that they were trying to figure out and they came up with a solution and now they have an opportunity to share it with the other counties. And then the state departments, who barely talks to all the counties, are able to now communicate with them. And so we're having this space where everybody is now communicating and there's no walls and barriers with that communication.
Was there something, an impetus, I guess, behind this task force kind of needing to be put into place?
I became the chair for economic development a year ago. And I talked to all the different businesses and all the different leaders in the industry and asked them, what can I do as the chair for economic development to move this state forward? And the first thing they told me was permitting. So I said, all right, you know what? I'm going to do my best to work on permitting. And after figuring out some of the challenges, I realize, okay, I think there's definitely a communication problem and people are only talking, these departments are only talking to themselves. We need to break these silos. And what I wanted to do was have the county departments, the state departments, and the users in the discussion. Typically, these working groups are just bureaucrats and not the actual users who's going to be using the process that they create. And I didn't want the government to just come up with the solution. I want them to be talking to the users. And so I integrated two homeowners. So these are like someone who has never pulled a permit and wants to build their home. Two family businesses, because that's who goes out for a permit. Two commercial developers and two residential developers. And that gives us a foundation of the people who's going to be using the process. And those who are regulating and actually creating that process. And you'd be amazed how different those perspectives are. For example, the county and the state, they're saying that we need more staffing because we don't have enough quality people to be able to do the job to make this work. But the users don't see that as a problem. They're like, no, there's plenty of staff. And what needs to be fixed is how complex your process is. It needs to be simpler. So then we have this give and take. So that's the balance that I have to manage and figure out.
That sounds like a monumental task, something you would need a task force to tackle.
Well, Kevin, like, have you probably heard from all your life that permitting has been an issue?
Yes, my entire life.
Exactly. And then who has ever led a statewide effort to reform permitting? No one. This is the first time. We talk about it constantly, but no one dares to actually attempt to figure it out. And I get it. I get why. There's so many areas. But like any complicated and impossible problem, you can dissect it in different components and try your best to work on that issue and then just build from there. We understand that we're not going to solve the permitting system all at once, but we can at least take a bite of some sort of plan at the end of this working group. And now we have a foundation where we could say, all right, we're going to try to deal with this problem. And then for the next 2 to 3 years, let's see what kind of results we can have.
And I think one of the ways that the state was kind of trying to deal with the problem, or at least Honolulu County was that we had implemented a new permitting system, H&L Build. It does implement some AI specifically in its Civ Check system. How do you feel as someone whose whole life right now is permitting?
Yes,
someone who's
my whole life is
knee,
permitting.
Knee
right now.
Deep in permitting. What are your takes on that?
Did you know that Big Island has a modernization effort called EPIC with their permitting system? So EPIC is the same with H&L Build, is in the sense of a permitting department modernizing into a digital platform instead of more like paper based. And then Maui has MAPS. That's another similar concept, just different name and probably different software. Then there's Click2Gov and in Kauai. And so what I'm trying to tell you is that, granted, City and County of Honolulu has a lot of applications to process, and they're on their early stage of modernizing. But EPIC had that attempt earlier, I think it was 2022 or 2021. So they've already gone through the growing pains and has a more modern system. This legislative session, what we wanted to do was figure out how to do some pre-compliance check with AI. So what that means is, because the department always says that it's the user error or the application that has so many errors that when they submit it, it delays the process because they don't have the application filled out correctly. I get that when it comes to like a new homeowner who has never gone through the process, but a developer who have repeatedly gone through this process is probably much competent and having less errors. But can you imagine using AI to give your application before you even send it to the permitting pipeline, and then it grades your application and says you filled it out correctly and it has zero errors, and now it's a perfect application going in, and now the review could be much easier. So that's the pre-compliance check. So we wanted to try to implement that in Hawaii Island because they're already modernized and they already have their process, where Honolulu is still going through the training with their employees, and it's going to take a while. The employees are still getting familiar with the software. So there's going to be some growing pains. But once the department personnel starts adapting and accepting that this is the new norm, it's going to be much faster and much easier.
And, you know, the Speed Task Force roughly has about another year in operation. You guys are slated to run until about 2027. Just thinking about quantifiable goals, do you have any deadline sets, and kind of looking at your progress over the past years, how confident are you, in being able to accomplish your objectives that you've really set out to do?
So we have some ambitious goals. And
that's great.
We're living up to the name. We're looking to have our final report finished by the end of this year. So in December, by January 1st of 2027, we should have our final report. And then we're going to have a speed summit in January 15, 2027 at the Sheraton, where we're going to convene and share the report. We're going to share the report beforehand, but have the workshops and really, really showcase what we could do for the state and the county. And then hopefully that legislative session in 2027, we can try to push out legislation. But keep in mind that we have realized that it's not only legislation, but it's also county legislation and also the department policy. So we don't need to technically do state legislation to make an impact and make a change. It could be the department themselves that they just have to change their policy to fix it. So we're taking into consideration that there's three actions that can be made, which is state level legislation, county legislation, or department policy changes. And hopefully that sets us a good step forward and really making a significant impact in permitting.
That was State Representative Gregor Iligan talking with HPR's Kevin Allen about the Speed Task Force for Hawaii's permitting process. Kick off Pineapple Week and International Pineapple Day with a look at Maui Gold. The company's been around for 100 years and is under new management. Owner Todd Domek stopped by our studios this morning to talk about all things pineapple, including where he'd like to take the company.
You know, we've only owned the business for about 3 years now, and it's a 100-year-old company, basically. And so we're coming in and looking at it with fresh eyes and trying to figure out how to do things differently to help sustain agriculture on Maui. And so we just opened a value-added processing facility. We're able to take fruit that we would normally throw away because it's too small or too ugly. We're doing dehydrated pineapple, fresh cut pineapple, frozen, and juice to start. And then we're going to branch off into other products in the future.
Well, you know, we were chatting just before this, and your background is in engineering. People may be scratching their heads, you know, why would you jump into something like this?
Well, by nature, engineers want to solve problems, right? And a 100-year-old pineapple farm, as you can imagine, has a lot of problems to solve. And so that's what's interesting to me is coming in and making improvements to the process, to the product, the quality of the product. So it's really just a desire to, you know, want to solve problems. And I'll say my professional background is in design and engineering, but I grew up in Kentucky fixing old cars and old buildings and stuff. And we just used our hands a lot and working on my grandfather's farm for a little bit. But always like saving stuff and restoring it and rehabilitating it. And so this is, albeit a great big project, you know, it feels like a project. And I'm still having fun at it. So
it's a challenge for you.
It is a challenge, yeah. We have about 30 union employees, ILWU workers that have been there, some of them 40, 50 years. Working for us, and so they're like the institutional knowledge of the company, and they make it a lot easier for us to innovate. We can say, hey, what if we tried this? And they will say, that's a bad idea because we did it 30 years ago or whatever. Mm-hmm. But a lot of times we can work with them and solve a problem at the farm in a way that frankly hasn't been done before.
So your attitude is, let's try this.
My attitude is, let's try it at a small scale, and if it works, then we go big scale.
Yeah. And you talked about when you first saw the business that there was a lot of product that was being thrown away.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, Maui Gold's a beautiful fruit, and it is designed to be sold fresh, wasn't designed to be a canned pineapple. But some of that fruit's small. Some of it's a little ripe, or some of it is a little ugly. And we were throwing away, you know, sometimes 10 tons of pineapple a week. So now we have this value-added processing facility, and we're not, our goal is zero waste. We're not quite there yet, but we process those pineapples. We replant the crowns. It's giving us more fruit, and we're pretty excited about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think of waste not, want not, right?
That's right, and the fruit still tastes great. It's the same exact fruit, but it's just harder to sell in a produce commodity market. So now we sell it in dehydrated bags and fresh cut, and we've got some here for you if you want to try it. There's absolutely no sugar at all. It's just 100% Maui Gold. It's not candied or anything like that. So it's everything we make is just 100% pineapple. We had a store on Front Street that burned. We made a pineapple salt serve that was just frozen Maui Gold stuck in a blender, and it's delicious. And we're going to do that again when we open our pineapple bar at our new pineapple store.
And so talk about the challenge, because you got into this business, and it was just before the wildfires, and so a lot of business went away because people were trying to be respectful, but there were a lot of businesses that were still operating, and they were having a difficult time because they had no customers.
Well, I bought Maui Gold pineapple in January of 2023. Before that, for the past 15 years or so, we've operated the Maui Pineapple Tour. And then in 2018, we started the Maui Pineapple Store on Front Street. It's always been to support Maui Gold and Hali'i Maui Farms. So we had a store on Front Street. We had an office and a warehouse, and it did all burn. But what was remarkable was that all of our team just chipped in, and we delivered pineapple on boats back to Lahaina. We told all of our employees, take our trucks, go do work for the community. We didn't have any tourists. Mm-hmm. We cut up pineapple, delivered it to food banks, and we did that for a very long time. You know, I hate that disaster happened, but it really showed me how resilient our employees are and how great our team is, and then also how much the community loved us and supported us. Our online pineapple sales for the month of August 2023 were four times what they should have been.
Wow. Because
people just said, hey, here's how I can help. We had people that would attach a note to the order and say, please don't send the pineapples. Send them to someone else, someone else's home. And it was just so much love about our farm and our products and our employees, and that was one of the best things that could have come out of that.
Wow. I mean, I think of pineapples and you think of hospitality, but in a way this was like reverse. It was the love coming back.
It really was, yeah. And it's, you know, we've started to recover from that. We rebuilt a brand new pineapple store at Haleemali Farms, much bigger, and it serves as a hub for our Maui Pineapple Tours as well. So that business is growing, and then you know, incrementally, we decided to do the value-added system next, and we're not sure what's next. What's next, I think, is grow more pineapple.
Well, you know, you folks are here in Honolulu this week, right, to kind
That's
of
right.
show off of some of the new products and some of the vendors that you've partnered with over the past couple of years.
So this is the dehydrated pineapple, and we've started this brand called Maui Pineapple Farm, and mostly it will be Maui Gold products, but it could be some other stuff in the future, so we kind of wanted to call it that. And then these are rings, so you can see the different shape pieces.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And what's cool is a lot of our restaurants that already buy Maui Gold, you know, they cut it up for a garnish for a drink or whatever.
Right, cocktails.
And so now we're able to sell them an already dehydrated ring for their cocktails. And so it reduces the waste for them. We sell them fresh cut fruit. They don't have to sit there and cut it up.
Right.
So it's the value for them as well. And then we sell 100% of what we produce. We don't have anything left at the end of the week. It all gets sold. So that allows us to sell more of the higher quality, really pretty fruit to the community.
Right, right.
And we do online sales too, but about 90% of the pineapple stays in Hawaii. We're committed to not ever selling more than 25% to the mainland, and we're keeping the majority of the product here in Hawaii.
Oh, interesting. Well, you know, I know at the airports, right, you often see the pineapple to go folks can bring back as gifts, you know, on the mainland.
Yeah, and it's most airlines don't count that against your checked baggage if it's pineapple, because it's some obscure deal they made years and years and years ago when pineapple was bigger. Yeah. So I've tested it on all the airlines. So.
Ah, okay. Well, and then I understand that, you know, with this being, you know, International Pineapple Week, there's all these activities going on. I know for the 250th anniversary, Maui's kicking off the parade, right, in Makawao. You That's folks right. are going to be, you know, out there in force.
Yeah, so this week we'll have our pineapple store has a lot of our vendors who use Maui Gold coming in to do pop-ups about their products. Yeah, we've got Kokovai, Vitality Hawaii, Maui Cocktail Kits, Maui Tea Shack, Farm to Fudge, 2B Organics, and Social Hour Coffee are all doing pop-ups in our store. And then on Saturday, which is the Makawao Rodeo Parade and also happens to be International Pineapple Day, we always take our tractor and a trailer and hand out hundreds of Maui Gold pineapples to the community. And John's making me wear a pineapple mascot costume this year. So if you see a dancing pineapple, that'll be me.
Okay, you'll be in disguise.
Right?
Well, you know, you've got this pineapple in front of you.
Yeah, I didn't mean to be stingy with it.
I can't resist a taste. And then, you know, with Maui Gold, I know we've always heard that it's a lot less acidic than maybe what people were used to.
Yeah, it doesn't burn your lips like a Costa Rican pineapple would. So it's really low in acid and really high in sugar, and you can eat the whole thing. You know, so a lot of pineapples will start to burn your tongue a little bit or the roof of your mouth. But what do you think?
I think it's great.
Okay.
Yeah, no, I'm a pineapple fan.
Okay.
So yeah, no problem for pineapple in the morning, first thing.
Yeah.
After coffee.
Yeah, exactly.
But talk about Costa Rica, because we often hear that that's where they just do, you know, the gangbusters, right?
Yeah, 78% of the pineapple consumed in the world is grown in Costa Rica. And it's great growing conditions. They don't have to irrigate their soil. In fact, they have to run irrigation. They get enough rain, and it just naturally grows there. So it's just a great growing condition. You can grow it year-round. And Costa Rica's it's big agriculture for sure, but we went there to see we're a 100-year-old company. What are these guys doing that's new and innovative? And one of the things that we saw was that they had almost zero waste. And so...
Wow.
So that was, you know, the trigger in our head, like, what else can we do? Let's stop throwing this food away and figure out another way to sell it. You know, so we're working on all those sustainability things. What was interesting, though, is we're kind of doing everything right. You know, back in the day when pineapple was really big in Hawaii, people from Costa Rica and people from Hawaii would share ideas and share innovation and so that they could all get better and grow a better product. And so when we did go there a year ago, you know, we learned that a lot of the stuff we're doing was on par with what they're doing, even though they're doing it at a bigger scale.
Right, right, yeah. So you're basically trying to do this one step at a time, but basically raise the profile and stay in business for another 100 years?
Well, I hope so. We've got a lot of mouths to feed. We've got about 70 employees in the company. And again, I just like I like saving things. Then there's no reason that we can't keep doing it. The community loves the product. And, you know, we have a tour business and a retail business that support a farm business. If it was just a standalone farm, it probably wouldn't survive. But because we have all these other people coming on the tour, 58,000 people last year came on the Pineapple Tour, those people become fans of the product. They tell their friends about it. They get online, MauiGold.com, and order some. And so that business keeps growing as well. What we have to do now is keep our quality up, which hopefully you like it.
Yes, quite yummy.
and then continue to grow more.
Anything else that you want to underscore as we celebrate Pineapple Week and Pineapple Day?
You know, I didn't even know there was an International Pineapple Day until I got involved with this company. But it's super fun. We're in the farming business, we're in tour business. We're always celebrating pineapple, but having it all focused in one week is really fun. And our team's done a great job this year with getting all these vendors in the store.
The whole idea is we acknowledge our plantation history, you know, and our roots, really. And then I don't know, but as far as plans then to put more pineapple into the ground,
yeah, we operate on a 757-acre piece of land that we're a tenant. We want to get to where we've got about 600 acres in the ground. It takes 18 months to grow a pineapple, right? And so the process is about a three-year crop. So 18 months to grow your first pineapple. A year later, you get a second one. And then we go fallow for about 6 months and then start over again. One of the interesting things that we've done when we bought the company was we're reducing the amount of like harmful chemicals
that you use.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I should say reducing, eliminating. And the result of that is we had to farm a little bit differently. Mm-hmm. We got to pay attention to the crop a little bit more. You know, that was an input that we stopped using, and we learned that we needed to space our pineapples out a little bit more. And so that goes back to the problem solving mm-hmm. thing that I love doing. Unfortunately, with pineapple, though, a mistake you make, you learn about it 18 months later financially, yes, yeah. Right? So yeah, it's a really fun business, and I think we're gonna make it.
Okay.
I think we're gonna be a good story of a little farm that innovated, and that innovation is this ecosystem where it all works together: tours, retail, online retail, and mm-hmm. agriculture.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank
for
you so much for having me.
Morning.
Yeah, and happy Pineapple Week.
And that was Todd Domek, owner of Maui Gold Pineapple Company, who is in Honolulu this week to spotlight Pineapple Week and International Pineapple Day, which is this Saturday, and which coincides with the Makawao Parade. That is it for us today. Tomorrow, we plan to take a closer look at Title IX. It's an anniversary of the landmark legislation, and we can thank Congresswoman Patsy Mink for her work in trying to change the world of sports. Got feedback for us? Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217. Find The Conversation as a podcast. Head to our website or search for it on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of The Conversation.